So today we're going to talk about, to be able to talk about the Andrew effect and many other related effects, we first need to talk about the notions of thermality, what it means to be thermal. Because thermality is slightly mysterious. This is a slightly mysterious thing, right? That when we have, the thermodynamics is amazing, but the laws of thermodynamics are a bit weird. You have the zero law that tells you that you can put things in thermal contact, whatever that is. And thermal contact is something that, well, once in thermal contact, you equilibrate to some thermal state, whatever that is. Thermal contact is funny. So if you have something at some temperature, you have something at a different temperature, you put them in contact, and the whole thing equilibrates eventually reaching a common temperature. Okay, what is thermal contact? What are the microscopics of that? Good question. All right, but thermal constancy, thermal contact is a notion that we take for granted. In fact, studying the microscopic models of thermal contact and what it means to equilibrate and what's really what's going on in terms of complexity theory, in terms of the coherence, it's part of what is studied now under the name of quantum thermodynamics, and it's non-trivial. It's highly non-trivial. In fact, even an interaction, if you pick your favorite interaction, chances are that under any interaction between two objects, something in a thermal state and something in a different state, they won't thermalize. So there's something going on. There's something with the environment going on, something about scrambling going on. But let's assume that thermal states, the thermal contact is a thing, and let's talk about thermal states. Now, notions of thermality that you've seen. I'm gonna jump over the Boltzmann notion of thermality, which is the one that you probably saw first, and I'm gonna go directly to Gibbs, the Gibbs notion of thermality. The Gibbs notion of thermality probably is the one that you're most familiar with, I assume. No, everybody has seen this. It's based on the second law. It's very simple. Thermalization is a spontaneous process. When I put something that is in a non-equilibrium state and I let it thermalize with an environment at constant temperature, my reasoning of the canonical ensemble, so I let the thing evolve and it spontaneously evolves towards equilibrium until it stops evolving, right? And when it's finished, we say it's an equilibrium state, and that state is a thermal state. Then Gibbs says, well, a second law tells me that in spontaneous processes, entropy can only increase. So of course, if the whole equilibration process to a thermal state is spontaneous, then entropy will always increase, and when it reaches a thermal state, entropy is maximized. So thermal states are the states that maximize entropy at constant energy. And that's, yeah.
So are we at a constant energy or constant temperature?
Constant energy.
But the canonical ensemble.
It derives from the canonical. So the canonical ensemble, what we're doing is we have an environment at constant temperature outside. All right?
But if we can exchange energy with the environment, we cannot have a constant energy.
Constant energy of the whole system, right? Of the ensemble.
Oh, I see. Okay.
That's when I formulated it from the quantum point of view. So what I say is that expectation of the Hamiltonian is fixed, right, in that state for the ensemble. There's an expectation, and that's why I wrote here expectations of energy. Okay. But yeah, so based on the second law, Gibbs formulates the Gibbs condition, which tells me what thermostates are. And it's very easy, probably you've done it. It's a quick exercise of Lagrange multipliers to prove that the state has this form. You probably have done that, no? In past courses. Now, this is what we call the Gibbs states. That Z has goes under the name of partition function. And then, of course, some other notion of thermality that in the case of Gibbs states is easy to prove is the notion of detailed balance that probably you've been exposed to. That's a non-trivial notion. I oversimplified it a little bit here. Detailed balance comes from fluctuation theorems. And basically, detailed balance is this notion of, the probability of something happening and the inverse process is the same. That's detailed balance. We reach some non-equilibrium stuff, but in equilibrium, right, the probability of something going one way and another has to be the same because we don't see anything happening at equilibrium. And then we apply this kind of notion of detailed balance to thermal states, and we can write something like the ratio between probabilities of backwards and forward transitions between two energy levels, then like omega I, omega j, should be proportional to the ratio of population. So if there's any difference between the probabilities of a forward and a backward process, it has to be because of population difference, because the probability for a single shot of a process would be the same both ways. And in particular, for a Gibbs state, the ratio between populations is the Maxwell-Boltzmann factor, which is this factor here. Now, we can apply to a qubit, because we're talking about the thermality of an under the weight detector will be obviously important for us. So if we apply for a qubit that has this display Hamiltonian here, then it's easy to see the detailed balance implies the probability of finding the state in the plus state in the Gibbs state is this. The probability of finding it in the ground state is 1 over the partition function. And the ratio is just the Boltzmann factor, of course, as it should be. These two notions of thermality you probably have seen before, so I'm not going to get a lot into them. They're deep, though. They both are deep. We could spend one lecture per each. Detailed balance is actually the one that's more complicated here, but I just oversimplified it. Any questions about any of this? This is all known stuff for you, right? If not, please do ask. Now, what is the problem with the notion of Gibbs thermality? The problem of the notion of Gibbs thermality is that Gibbs thermality can only be defined under some circumstances. In particular, when this operator, the exponential of minus beta h, is trace class. If this operator is not trace class, the notion of Gibbs thermality is not well defined. In particular, in quantum field theory, these kind of operators are not trace class. The partition function does not exist. I mean, you know that probably from many of the other courses and maybe popular culture, that really we don't know what partition functions are. We can compute ratios of partition functions because they're divergent, these things. The ratios are okay under some circumstances, right? And that's what we do, and we have many tricks to do these things. We have many, many tricks that we learned throughout the ages, right? We have we can do path integral methods, we can do replica tricks, we can do many things to try to compute ratios of partition functions. But partition functions themselves are not well defined. So the notion of Gibbs thermality for a quantum field is not well defined. You cannot write a Gibbs state for a quantum field unless you do something, as in like putting in a cavity, which is the way in physics usually is done. So we put it in a cavity, we take the walls of the cavity to infinity, and we assume the limits commute, and then we talk about a notion of Gibbs thermality locally. But definitely, the state of the field is not a Gibbs state. We need to generalize the notion of thermality in order to apply it to quantum fields. And that's where this other new definition, new for some of you, maybe not new for everybody, of thermality plays a role. All right, let's talk about KMS thermality. This is Kubo, Martin, Swinger. That's the K, the M, and the S of KMS. All right. So let me write a definition. And then we'll analyze the definition. Let H be a Hamiltonian that generates time translations parameterized by a time parameter tau. All right? So that Hamiltonian is partial tau, if you want. Generates translations in the direction of partial tau. And let u equals e to the minus I h tau be the corresponding time evolution operator. The language of mechanics, the exponential map of that thing. If we were super rigorous, the pullback, but you know what I mean, the usual stuff. A density operator rho is a KMS state with respect to tau, well, to h and tau. I mean, I'm going to be over explicit. I could just say tau. With inverse temperature, inverse KMS temperature beta, if for any pair of bounded operators, well, bounded, let me write Heisenberg picture operators, let me define them, A of tau equals U dagger A of zero U, B of tau, what's the definition if you want? U dagger B zero U. Let's see. A density operator rho is a KMS state with respect to H and tau. And in fact, the way you say it is KMS with respect to the Hamiltonian H in the direction of tau with inverse KMS temperature beta is for any pair of bounded Heisenberg picture operators A and B. The following conditions are satisfied. So the KMS condition is actually two conditions. Many times when it's used in practice, the second one is the only one that's mentioned, but the first one is as important, if not more, as we will see, is super important for the thermalization of detectors when we get there. All right, so first condition, one, the expectation values A zero, B tau on the state row, and B tau A zero on the state row. Notice here that we're not assuming for the you start seeing the power of this definition the moment that I define this to separate. I'm not assuming this thing is a trace. So this can apply even to cases where this is not a trace, the expectation value on row. Okay, we will mention that later a little bit. R boundary values of some complex functions A zero B of Z rho and B of Z A zero. Holomorphic in the complex strips. Let's see if I write this right. Beta and minus beta imaginary Z zero, respectively. So first, the holomorphicity condition. This is the one that is often ignored when you see the KMS condition used in the wild. People check one thing, and usually it's not this. I mean, of course, sometimes it is, obviously. But it's not strange to not see that checked first. Huh? First, I demand, again, look at this. Huh? These things can be extended in a holomorphic way to the strip. This one to this strip, this one to the other strip. That's the first condition. Holomorphicity condition of this correlator. It is a correlator in time, in a way. I mean, it's not really a correlator, but kind of. Huh? To be a correlator, you have to symmetrize that, and you have to subtract the expectations. But it's a two-point function, in a way, in time. Well, is that condition understood? Do ask if not. You're saying, like, no?
No, I didn't get it. So when right. You plug in Z, like, as Z, whose imaginary part is beta?
No, the Z, the imaginary part could be anything, but I'm saying that at least in that strip, so take this one. What I say is that I can exchange the real variable tau by a complex variable and extend holomorphically this to a complex function. There's gonna be no poles in this strip. So I need to require to be able to do that. If I get the function, whatever this function is, that thing has to be the boundary value of something that is really well behaved in that strip.
Yeah, but the first one is the boundary value of the A0 beta of tau is the boundary value of A0 beta of Z in which of the two boundaries? In MZ equals 0 and MZ equals B?
Boundary value as in like tau, right? Tau when beta equals 0.
When the imaginary part of Z equals 0.
In both cases. One is from above, one is from below. Right? Now this is important to understand because this is not for show or because we've been two pure mathematicians here, not at all. We will need this condition for the Andrew effect, for the thermalization of detectors. It's super important. There's at some point, I'm gonna have to use a property of the Fourier transform, and I get something that is not a Fourier transform, and I'm screwed unless I have this property. So super important that we understand this property. Okay. Any more questions about that? Second, this is the one that probably, I mean, you knew about the KMS condition, probably seen the second one, the complex antiperiodicity of this thing. The second part of the KMS condition says that the boundary values of these complex functions satisfy complex antiperiodicity. I'll define what that is. With period beta. So the expectation of A0 beta of tau plus I beta, so B tau plus I beta on rho. It's equal to beta of tau A0 of rho. So that's the second condition. That's the most famous condition, the one that you see applied when you start reading things. Now, this is kind of interesting, right? Because the notion of thermality, instead of talking about the second law, instead of talking about maximizing entropies, it's just saying thermal states are funny objects that for any bounded operators, A and B are any bounded operators, any, that you can build up acting on the Hilbert space of where Rho lives, right? For any bounded operators, you get that the time correlators between two of the, think of them as observables, for example. The time correlator, if it's a finite dimensional Hilbert space, certainly the self-adjoint ones are all bounded. In an infinite dimensional one, we're just talking about the bounded ones. The time correlators satisfy something really funny. They're periodic. So when time is considered imaginary, it's periodic. There's some periodicity in the evolution under imaginary time. And the periodicity in evolution under imaginary time is the freaking temperature. That's pretty cool in itself. It's like when I'm presented with this, I'm like, I want to know more. Why? No, I mean, tell me. I mean, this. I mean, I can see how the you when I make an imaginary time, I get a thermal something, Gibbs-like feeling. But come on. Huh? Do you agree? This is pretty. Like what? Seriously, that's thermal? How? No? I don't know. Do you have any opinions or impressions about this? Does it seem that this is any related to the Gibbs definition?
Isn't this something related to what we did in QFT about big rotation that you kind of...
Maybe. Okay, tell me more about that.
I mean, over there, we also had this periodicity in temperature, so...
Right, you use something like KMS condition, for sure. And then what's your intuition about it? So if you have to convince, imagine I'm a very skeptical person, and you tell me this is thermality. Forget about Gibbs, this is thermality. And I said, no, hold on, why? What would you say to me?
It's just kind of a reparametrization.
The what, sorry?
Like you're just kind of changing your time to some complex variable. So.
Right. So I guess this is an argument that can be done waving hands, saying, sure. Look, come on. If you have time evolution and this thing is IHT, right? If I take T to be minus I beta, right? Then this thing is, yeah, certainly something like minus beta H. No, I beta. So, sure, well, because I define it like that, right? So minus I beta. So, sure, this thing is thermal. So, yeah, that's kind of the way to say, okay, maybe there's something in it. But you see, the reason I told you about this is because I'm not satisfied with e to the minus beta h, because that thing is problematic in field theory. So first, I think I would need to convince you that this is more powerful than the Gibbs thermality that I define. No? That's what I'm going to do. So in fact, I'm going to prove several things. I'm going to prove that KMS states are stationary. Right? If they weren't stationary, well, bad business, because thermal states are certainly stationary. Stationarity is a necessary condition for a thermal state. I'm going to prove also that when Gibbs is well-defined, then KMS, the KMS condition, is satisfied if and only if you have a Gibbs thermal state. That should be enough proof that is at least as good as Gibbs. But this also is well-defined outside Gibbs. Now, of course, when you generalize something, so then that if I prove this, that what we have in our hands is a generalization of Gibbs thermality, right? It's Gibbs thermality whenever Gibbs thermality is well-defined and something else when not. A generalization could be a good one or a bad one, right? I mean, I can get a definition of some that for divergent sums, I say, well, it's 42. Just write 42 when it's divergent, and sure. And when not, well, it's the sum that you know. And it's certainly a generalization of the sum. It's just a pointless one, a dumb one that doesn't tell me anything, right? I will need more convincing to argue that the KMS condition not only is Gibbs whenever Gibbs is well-defined, it's still thermal in what we value from thermality in the zero law notion of thermality when Gibbs is not well-defined. And I will do that. That's going to be a next lecture. Huh? Because what we're going to do is we're going to get a thermometer, going to get a KMS state whenever Gibbs is not well-defined, but KMS is. I'm going to stick a thermometer to that KMS state, which is, let's say, a finite-dimensional system where Gibbs is well-defined. And then if everything is fine, that thermometer should thermalize. If we have thermal contact, the thermometer should actually read a temperature. And if that Gibbs temperature of the thermometry, or the thermometer coincides with the KMS temperature, then fine. Then KMS is certainly a notion of thermality we can rely upon. So that's the journey we are starting right now. Questions about that? That's the plan.
Yeah, I'm not sure where I see what KMS state is. How do you define the KMS state? These are the conditions.
So let's read the definition and understand, because this is a definition, huh? And it's a definition, so we need to understand every ingredient in it. So a KMS state, to say KMS, you say KMS rho with respect to the Hamiltonian H in the direction of time tau. Okay? So it's a state that for any pair of Van der Heisenberg operators like this, any pair, these two conditions are satisfied. That's the definition. So we call a state thermal if, with respect to some Hamiltonian, with respect to some time direction. So interesting enough, perhaps there are states that can be thermal with different temperature with respect to different times, their time directions. That's what's behind the Andrew effect. So you can have states, certainly, that are KMS with different temperatures with respect to different times. Okay? Anyway, so, right. So that row has to satisfy first. We need to be able to, these correlators, we need to be able to extend them to the complex plane. And not only extend them in any way, they have to be extended holomorphically on that strip, at least. Second, I need the boundary values to satisfy this complex antiperiodicity condition. Like, things become periodic in imaginary time with the period being the temperature. That's the definition. Is that clear? It's a definition, eh? So should be clear. All right, so the first thing I'm going to prove is that KMS states are stationary. Now, we're going to have to use a lot of complex analysis. Well, a lot, no. Actually, it's basic complex. I say a lot because usually the people I teach this thing are not that much into complex analysis because they're usually like four-year physics students that some of them have, and some of them have not seen complex analysis. But I assume everybody here has at least taken a course in complex analysis, right? If anybody has not, just let me know.
What? Taken a course in complex analysis?
Have you taken complex analysis? No? You know some complex analysis? PSI. If I say Morera's theorem, do you know what I mean? No. Okay, that's the weirdest theorem. Liouville's theorem, though.
What?
Liouville? That one, yes? Hopefully? No? I'm going to use these two theorems, that's all. Other than that, it should be easy to follow. But I'll tell you what the theorems say, more or less. And I say more or less because, more or less, we'll talk about it. All right. So if I tell you that something is bounded and holomorphic in the whole complex plane, do you know what that something is?
Constant.
A constant. I'm going to use that. Okay, so that's anyway. Right. Let's prove stationarity. So let's prove KMS implies stationarity. So what is stationarity to begin with? Stationarity. Right. A state rho is stationary if the statistics of all its observables, right, of all the observables, are time independent. Agreed? So stationary if expectation of B of, let's call it B of T on rho equals the expectation of B of zero for any B. Yep.
You're using D now.
Well, yeah, that's
so it's like with respect to any.
That's better, yeah. I could have called it T here. And probably my life would be better, but I called it tau. So I will maybe forget sometimes. So if I write a T, I mean the parameter with respect to the thing is KMS. All right? All right. So that's stationary. So let's see if KMS implies this for any, of course, B. All right. So let's pick KMS. Right, KMS condition two, because we can assume any of the things that KMS tell me to prove this. KMS condition two with A equals identity, which is a bounded operator. Right, so now for convenience, let's call D the region in the complex plane the strip of the upper strip of the complex plane from 0 to beta. Okay? Now, condition one implies that there is some f, let's call it f of z, that I call beta of z. Oops. Expectation of beta of z in rho. And that thing is holomorphic in D. It's also continuous on the boundary. All right. The second condition tells me the following. F of tau plus I beta equals F of tau. Okay. And now with that, we play and we should get stationarity. Let's play. Let's first prove. Let's prove f of z is bounded on D and the boundary of D. So let's write z equals x plus iy. Stop me if at any point there's something that you are like, not okay with, stop me, okay? Let's write that. And then use Barth's inequality. So what I mean by that is the following. Right. F of z, modulus of f of z, which is equal, of course, the modulus of expectation of b of z rho modulus. That thing is less or equal than the norm of b of z, of course. Where the norm is the supreme norm, let me just write the norm. The norm of an operator b of z is the supremum for a vector b, of course, of b, of the modulus of b of z acting on the vector b, right? Maybe I should write as a state, but whatever. I mean, maybe I'll write it like this for convenience of writing. But that's the norm of, so maybe I'll just write it like that. So this is a vector, right? The norm of that vector. That's what I mean. For vectors of norm one. But that's the usual. Yeah.
That seems a bit like cheating, right? Because
why?
I don't have guaranteed the fact that. I mean, the notation f of z equals b of z, the expectation value of b of z,
In
the spirit of the KMS condition, is symbolic. There is no reason
totally why symbolic.
The operator b of z has to exist.
I'm talking about the observables, right? I'm particularizing the KMS condition to the observables of my system. B is an arbitrary observable of my system.
Yeah, but there's no reason why b can be extended into the complex plane.
Oh, so that's the point. I'm assuming KMS. KMS part one tells you that yes, you have to if you want KMS.
But it tells you that you can extend the expectation value, but not the expectation value into the expectation value of some operator.
I extended this expectation value taking the operator A to be identity and B an arbitrary operator.
But you also have rho. I mean, that's the expectation value instead of operator.
Hold on. So this is an identity, this is math, as in like this, there's no physics or assumptions here. So this is the thing that the KMS tell me, right?
Yes.
But I know, Barth's theorem, right? That whatever this expectation, the expectation value of B is always less or equal than the norm of the operator, because the norm of the operator is defined. So what is an expectation value? An expectation value, so if you have, I was cheating in the sense that I'm using a trace, that's what you mean?
I don't have a problem with that. I mean, I don't have a problem with Schwarz inequality.
Okay.
I have a problem with the existence of B, of Z.
But I'm not sure why, because condition one tells me that it exists.
Oh, I thought so. You literally mean...
I assume KMS is true.
In there, you literally mean that A0 B of tau can be extended into some A0
that's right.
Z for some operator B of Z?
For all of them. So the KMS condition is pretty strong. It's telling you that for all bounded operators, all of them, every single one of them, this can be built. So all of them can be extended analytically to the strip. Holomorphically, not analytically. So that's the condition. So it's not cheating. I'm assuming it's true. No, I like this. This is the kind of thing. I'm assuming this is true. And with that, I'm going to, assuming one and two, I'm going to go ahead. So because I assume one, this is what I'm getting. I get an FZ that is holomorphic in the strip because one tells me that it exists for all of them, for all the operators that you can think of. Otherwise, you're not KMS. Yeah?
I think that there are two different things, right? One of them is saying that you have this holomorphic function, which on the boundary is equal to the expectation values of these things.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is saying that you get a family of operators defined on a complex plane, which is B of Z.
Yeah.
I think that's Ivan's problem, right?
Yeah, that's my problem.
So this is for any...
The KMS condition, the way that I know it, doesn't require that second one, that there exists that family of operators.
So for any pair of bounded Heisenberg operators, I said there. That includes all of them.
No, my problem is to extend B of tau into a B of Z.
Ah.
That sort of assumes that you can already make the e to the ih tau and e to the ih tau plus I beta.
But I'm extending the expectation value, though. I'm extending this thing.
Exactly. That I'm good with, extending expectation values. But then that doesn't guarantee the existence of the operator B of Z, and then we cannot use Schwarz inequality. Because the notation expectation value of B of Z is completely, like, symbolic.
Yeah. Fair enough. So assuming there exists the operator, so there are observables. So what we assume here is that we have also the framework of quantum mechanics in which there's at least a family of observables that are represented by operators, self-adjoint operators in the Hilbert space. And I'm saying that there are such bounded operators here. So if you think of finite dimensional, you should have no problem with it. Infinite dimensional, you may have some problem with it, and we will deal with them at the very end. Not of this lecture, probably. But yeah. And then I think I know what you mean now. So yeah, definitely. I'm assuming that this B exists, right? So my choice is I take AD identity, and I take B observables of the system that are assumed to exist on the framework of we have a quantum system with observables. So basically postulates of quantum mechanics together with that. There are observables, and those observables are represented by self-adjoint operators. And in particular, some of those observables are gonna be these guys. Now, you can argue, what about observables that are not bounded operators in infinite dimensional systems? And we will discuss that at the very end, because you can still do these things, not as simple as I'm doing right now. You have to work with them. Well, you have to build bounded operators out of them.
Then what's the definition of the exponential value? Is it you will use a trace or something?
So for this assumption, I'm assuming that this is working with the rules of the usual quantum mechanics. So yes, for this particular thing, so the notion of stationarity as expectation values being that, I'm defining it in the sense of quantum mechanics. So yeah, I do have observables. B.
I mean, to use the Schwarz inequality, you needed the definition to be the trace of. Okay.
That's right. So I'm using that definition here. So what I'm proving here, again, we're working in the framework that Gibbs is well defined. So everything that I'm talking about here is going to be in the framework that Gibbs is well-defined. And in that framework, you do compute things with traces. But the thing is that KMS generalizes that framework. No? All right?
So if Gibbs is not well-defined, we cannot even prove that KMS is stationary.
Oh, we can. Yeah, we can. But not like this.
Okay.
All right?
So I think that now I get it. So in this case, it's as if like you went to the U there, which is e to the minus ih tau, and you plugged in tau equals z.
Yes.
Where z is complex, and that's how you define operator b.
That is exactly right.
Okay.
So look at the definition of the a's, right, and the b's. So these are the definitions, right? And the u is the exponential of this thing, of this Hamiltonian.
Because we are in the case where Gibbs states are well defined.
No, the definition of Gibbs-Hermite doesn't require that. But here we are. In the proof that we're doing, we are, yes. So all that I want to prove to you now is that all the properties that Gibbs states have when Gibbs is well-defined, KMS also have, which is non-trivial from seeing the definition. That clear then? All right. Yeah, I'm probably gonna run out of time, but I'm gonna try anyways. I mean, I'm enjoying this though. Don't get me wrong. I like this. All right. Where were we? Yeah, here. So because of this, right? On D, we have that the modulus of F is bounded by M, which is of course where M is the supremum of the norm of B I bar. Oh, I didn't. I need some more steps. Right. So modulus of F of Z, it's equal to BZ, right? Modulus, which is less or equal than, as I said, norm of B of Z. That's what I had before. And this thing is equal to norm of B X plus I Y. Then we use the definition of B of tau that we just mentioned as the Hamiltonian. This thing is the same as the norm of e to the I h x e, sorry, b I y e to the minus I h x. These are unitary operations, so the norm is the same. So this thing is the norm of b I y. All right, so that means that F, at least on D, F of Z is less or equal than M equals the supremum of B, the norm of B I Y, with Y from 0 beta. All right, and the supremum is actually attained. So calling it supremum here, I could say maximum, because this is a compact set. So it is attained. All right, and then what we conclude then is that F is bounded on 0 less or equal than the imaginary part of Z less or equal than beta. Okay. Any questions about that? Yeah.
How did we go from B of X plus IY to the next thing?
From here to here?
Yeah.
The definition of B of T. B of tau, it's U dagger, B0, U, right? And then U is the exponential of minus H tau. Change the tau for a z, and change the z by x plus iy. Right? So if you want an intermediate step here, this is e to the I h x e to the minus y, let's see, to the I h x plus iy. Beta of 0, e to the I h x plus minus I h x plus I y. I put the I y part inside, and I leave out the x part.
But why we put the I y part?
The I y part, because I want to prove that this boundary is not in that strip, right? I want this. So I want this norm. And this norm, so this norm is bounded in this region. So F is bounded in this region. So I wanted to express the modulus of F to be less or equal than some number, and some number that I know is bounded, and I know the norm of this guy is bounded. Okay? Because remember, what we're working with is the fact that B is a bounded operator.
So it's bounded even in the complex plane, like complex
tree. That's right. Here, more or less. And you can always ask questions the next day as well, huh? Because this is the kind of thing that you need to read through sometimes. All right. Cool. So F is bounded. So now we also know, right, F is bounded on D. Union boundary of D, And also, f of tau, it's equal to f of tau plus I beta. All right, so let's do two steps. So let me plot it. So what I'm saying here is that I have the region in the complex plane. This is Iy, this is x. In the complex plane, I have this region, and I have that f is bounded in this region. But I also know that f has to be periodic. This here, and also this here, and also this here. So in this line, if I pick a line, I can extend the function to another strip. Maybe I should do the one below. I can extend the function to another strip because of the periodicity condition. So basically, what this condition is telling me is that that strip that I have here has to be copied here. The periodicity, of course, is not defined on the boundary, though. It's defined on the rest, because remember, the KMS condition has a less than, not a less or equal than, so it's not saying anything about this. But basically, what this is telling me is that the function f, whatever the value of the function f is here, I can copy it here. I know what the result is here. I can copy it here. And in fact, I can do many copies of it, because I know it has to satisfy complex periodicity. So if I go on this direction, I have to copy all the values in here, except perhaps for the boundaries, right? Because I'm not saying anything about the boundaries. But I have to copy all these values, and I have to put them here. And I can repeat the same thing here, and then here, and so on and so forth. So you can cover the whole complex plane like that, except for lines, the boundaries that join. Is that clear? So we prove two things. F is bounded. Whatever F is here is bounded. Doesn't go crazy. And second, there are copies of whatever bounded values of F here are copies here by strips. You can go on strips and build the whole complex plane like that, except for the lines that are the boundaries.
But for the second issue of KMS, you said that boundary values of the other antiporosity. So, in my understanding, is the antiporosity of the boundary instead of antiporosity.
No, the point is that we're not demanding anything about. We only demand continuity to be boundary values.
Yes.
That means it's continuous, so the limits here will be the same, right?
Yes, yes.
But it's not saying that they have to be holomorphic on the lines. So that's the point. You see, boundary values exist in the region. So this is talking about holomorphicity in the open set, not in the closed set.
Okay.
All right? That's a technicality. I could have just overlooked it right in this, but that wouldn't be the KMS condition. And there are some cases where it would fail if we don't do that carefully. However, it's fine, because what I'm about to invoke is Morera's theorem. And by Morera's theorem, you get holomorphic continuous. So there's a path. You can actually write a path like that. And if it's holomorphic on the sides, on the lateral limits, and continuous, then it's analytic as well in here. OK? For this particular case. So Morera's theorem, so I know that F is bounded. And it's bounded everywhere. The values on the boundary exist as the lateral limits, right? But it's also F is holomorphic in the whole complex plane. All right? So if it's bounded and holomorphic, what can it be? We already said it. It's a constant. So we know that f of z is a constant. Let me call it f of z, some constant f of 0. In particular, f of tau is also f of 0. What does that mean? That means that the expectation of b of tau on rho is equal to the expectation b of 0 for any bounded operator, in particular, for any self-adjoint operator, for all the observables of the system. OK?
Yeah, just to make sure again, in your second condition of KMS, your tau is secret z, you can take the complex value.
Sorry, what?
In your second condition of KMS, the tau can take complex value.
Yeah. That's
okay.
So that what we are saying is that there's the functions with z's instead of tau's,
yeah.
For which the t's are the boundary values.
Okay.
All right? When beta is 0. This is the most, if you want, steppy of the proofs. The other proofs are much easier. If you got this one and no more nuances on this one, the other ones will be much easier. I think that I can do it if I can take until 4:15. That's or not really. Ah. Okay. Well. Huh? Okay, then I'll do the shortest one, and then a bit longer one for the next day. Okay, I was going to do, so the two things that are, so I proved this already, KMS are stationary, KMS states are stationary, which is a necessary condition. I have to prove that when Gibbs is well-defined, KMS is actually exactly Gibbs. And I need to prove the two directions. So I'm gonna prove first, which one? Yeah, let's prove that KMS implies Gibbs when Gibbs is well-defined. And I'll do the inverse tomorrow, generalize tomorrow. Let's prove. Yeah, because I don't remember when the next lecture is. Let's prove KMS implies Gibbs. That's easier, right? Because Gibbs, we need to prove the first and the second. That's easier, because the only thing that I need to find out, well, we will see. It's kind of fun. All right, so we assume KMS is true, so we assume we have condition two. So assuming two, at tau equals zero, we get the following. The trace, and now I can write traces, because I'm gonna talk about the case where Gibbs is well-defined, so I can write traces. Trace of a zero, e to the minus beta h, oh, let's write the whole thing, because I didn't write the whole thing here. This is so fun. Minus beta h, b of zero. I only wrote the result, but it's much easier it's much nicer if we actually do it. B of zero, rho, equals to the trace of, and then I get b of zero. Trace rho, of course. A zero, rho. All right, let's put everything on the left. So I get the trace of A zero, common factor of, let's see, so this B, I move here, okay? And then I get common factor of E to the minus beta H B of zero, rho, and plus minus, rho, B of zero, equals zero. Agreed?
Is there an e to the beta h on the right side of?
Oh, yes. My bad. And here as well. E beta h rho. Thank you. It wouldn't have worked without that. All right, agreed now? If I didn't forget anything? All right. So now what we do is, let's multiply it and divide by this. So what we get is that the trace of A zero, and then I take that out. E to the minus beta h, that multiplies B of zero, E to the beta h, rho, minus E to the beta h, rho, B of zero, equals zero, right? Aha. But that object, that's the commutator between e to the beta h rho and b zero. So what I'm saying is that the trace of a of zero minus beta h, now commutator of b of zero with e to the beta h rho has to be zero. Agreed? Right. Now, two steps, two cool steps. This is true for any A and for any B, because two, right? From the KMS condition. Well, if it is true for any A first, if it is true for any A, that means that the only way this is never gonna be zero, the only way this is gonna be zero for any A is if the commutator is zero. So, that means that this commutator is zero. But if that commutator is zero, right? But B is, again, any operator, right? By KMS. We are in a finite dimensional system here. We have Gibbs and so on, so this is any operator. Okay, what is the only operator that commutes with everything? Multiple of, anyways, right? So this thing has to be equal or multiple of the identity, equals some constant. Let me call this constant whatever. I don't know what to call it. C. It's not going to be 1 over Z. Yeah. Let me call the constant 1 over Z because I can. Identity. But that means that rho is equal to e to the minus beta h 1 over Z, which is the Gibbs state. All right? So that proves that KMS implies Gibbs. So we've proven this one, or half, right? Proven this one. Whenever Gibbs is well defined, KMS implies Gibbs. How much time? Probably zero?
You can take a couple minutes.
Couple minutes?
That might also be a good time.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, sure, because if I were only proving condition two, I could do it in 2 minutes, but I need to prove condition one. And that's again analysis, so maybe I'll save it for the next day, but I'll do like gathering remarks here and so on. Right, so we have the definitions. We have the definitions of the KMS condition here. The KMS condition, remember, is a definition that is way more general. Way more general than what I've done on that side. It's a definition that does not require you to have even traces, or you can go Weinmann with it. You can go algebraic field theory with it and say, well, these are not traces. This is some map that associates, you know, the two-point functions with some number and stuff, and still you can get the KMS condition working. The KMS condition is a condition of, first, holomorphicity on the two-point functions and the time evolution, and then complex periodicity of the time evolution, of the correlators and the time evolution. And that's kind of weird, as in like, so being thermal, are you telling me that being thermal means that all your observables right now, all your observables, if you thermalize with the room, all your observables are periodic in the complex plane. If you get all your correlators between your observables in time, your correlations with your future observables, those things are periodic in imaginary time just because you're thermal. So it's highlighting a connection between the correlations, the property of the correlations of the system, and the thermality of the system. And then what we've seen is that, well, that weird condition on the, let's say, behavior of the time correlators of your observables, that weird condition, actually implies Gibbs whenever Gibbs is well-defined. Well, that is weird, though. I mean, I would say, if I'm presented with that and I say, this is equivalent, I would have loved, imagine that I already proved it. Huh? And then we can say, yeah, it's the same thing. And you say, no, but Gibbs, I prefer Gibbs because it's the same. So Gibbs, this is Gibbs. Whenever Gibbs is well-defined, this is double implication. So you cannot argue this is different or worse or anything. It's exactly the same. The only different thing is that when Gibbs is not well-defined, this thing still is. It's more abstract than Gibbs. It allows you to take it to places Gibbs have never been before. All right? Now, one question that I got sometimes, but I didn't have it this time, so probably you don't have that question, but I'll say it. Many people would say, but you're assuming the H is time independent. And then, yeah, of course. H has to be time independent, because otherwise you cannot define equilibrium states anyways. Okay. Any questions or anything about this notion of Gibbs thermality? So is that the KMS notion that you've seen before?
No, I come from people of AQFD, so more.
Oh, nice. Who?
I work with Andres Reyes and Nayalan Balachandran.
Right. Oh, cool. So you've seen the more abstract definition, yeah. That's why you were asking those questions. Those were really good questions. Yeah, sure, sure. So on this board, I'm working in the realm of usual quantum mechanics. You have the postulates of quantum mechanics. And I would say, I don't know what your opinions are coming from that background, but I think that's the most powerful background to do field theory by far. Anyway, any more questions you may have? Cool. So now you have a powerful notion of thermality that you can use for many of the things that you're going to do in your life. And the first one is going to be the tutorial today. So you're going to get to use KMS right now. All right. Remember, we still have to prove this direction. Huh? So you can trust me for now and say, OK, but always be skeptical until you see the proof. Because who knows? Maybe I'm trying to sell you something that doesn't follow.